Here is the news of the world, direct by shortwave from overseas. And first, to Australia, which comes by way of San Francisco.
MacArthur's headquarters here tells of a dawn attack made by our torpedo planes on a Jap naval force in the Solomon Islands. Our plane swept in for a close-range shot at the flotilla, which was at anchor in Paisi Harbor. Although poor visibility prevented an accurate observation and check, it is believed that our torpedoes hit three Jap light cruisers and two medium merchant vessels. In New Guinea, our fighters made another sweep of the Kokoda jungle track. They successfully strafed an enemy warehouse and a number of supply huts. At Kokoda itself, our medium bombers kept up their daily average and once again smashed the Wairopi Bridge. This time, three of their heavy demolition bombs found the target. The whole eastern end of the bridge, which the Japs had been repairing throughout the night, was destroyed. In the Owen Stanley Range, our troops are still advancing northwards. Last official reports now place them at Ifoji. This means that they have advanced about 20 miles to this point from Uribaiwa in 7 days. Since the Australian troops started to push the Japs back a week ago, they have not once been attacked by the enemy's air arm, or have they been contacted his main ground forces. This is described here as being the most puzzling feature of the New Guinea campaign. Yesterday at Ifoji, our troops found more abandoned enemy stores and equipment. Obviously, the Japs are still on the run. What's more, our pilots reported that the trail from Ifoji all the way northward through Kokoda to Buna appears deserted. Bombers saw little signs of activity. The Australians, both hardened AIF campaigners back from the Middle East and militia seasoned in New Guinea, have learned plenty since they were first pushed out of Kokoda by the Japs. They are smarter opponents now. Their patrols are feeling their way along, conscious of the possibility of ambush. They know the Jap is one of the wiliest of fighters that ever pulled a trigger or a trick. There is another bit of news from New Guinea reported in today's communique. It is to the effect that our ground forces executed a surprise raid against the enemy at Mubo. Mubo is over on the northwest coast of New Guinea, well above Buna, deep in the heart of Japanese territory. Mubo has been described as an advanced supply base for Salamoa and Leh. It is indeed well off the beaten track for our forces. While there are absolutely no details given as to how our troops accomplished this surprise raid, it takes little imagination to picture a very efficient commando force, most capably organized and well-equipped for jungle-guerrilla warfare. Beyond stating that at least 25 casualties were inflicted, there is no other information as to what damage was done in this lightning raid. This is George Thomas Folster. I now return you to San Francisco.
From San Francisco, we return you to the newsroom in New York.
We turn next to the Russian capital for the latest developments on that front. Go ahead, Moscow.
This is Robert Magidoff speaking from Moscow. There is no slowing down in the inhuman pace of the battle for Stalingrad. The German losses keep mounting from day to day, but Field Marshal von Buck dares not relax his pressure in the face of the active resistance of the defenders. And the continued Red Army advance from the northwest adds fuel to the scorching flames of this resistance. The result is that the Germans are throwing to the battle all incoming reinforcements straight from the march. But even this has proved insufficient to replace their enormous losses. And so, various auxiliary troops, such as road builders, pontoon crews, and others, have been sent into Stalingrad, where every house is defended the way a man defends his life. Many a Stalingrad house has already changed its tenants 10 times or more in less than a month. Germans, Italians, Romanians, Slovaks, and other would-be tenants are clamoring for more houses, but General Rogintsev and his Russian troops keep evicting them even from the places in their possession. Hitler has promised his disappointed house hunters that the whole city will soon be theirs, but the Red Army apparently has different ideas on the subject. As a matter of fact, there are indications that the Russians are settling down for a long stay. Some units defending Stalingrad have sent delegates to another large Volga city to get for them victrolas, guitars, books, writing papers, pencils, and other essentials for recreation and pastime. Not long ago, the most compelling slogan in Stalingrad was, "Make every home a fortress." Now, as defenders say, "Make every fortress a home." The Germans have been deadlocked not only at Stalingrad. In the Mazdak area, where they are less than 50 miles from the coveted Grozny oil fields, the Germans have been held for more than a month. And this, in spite of the more than 100 major tank attacks they have undertaken during this period. Most of the fighting has been raging on the approaches to a vital valley amid the wild, rugged mountains of the Caucasus. The losses of the Panzer have been so heavy that beginning with Friday, the Germans abandoned mass tank attacks and began to send out their tanks in very small groups. At one place in this area, the Germans yesterday crashed their way into a settlement. Street fighting is raging there at this very moment. Goodbye from Moscow.
Now, across the Atlantic to the British capital for the report of Alex Dreyer in London.
But they believe in that world and they despise you and me. Ray.
Just one moment, ladies and gentlemen. We hope to bring you Alex Dreyer in just a moment.
The majority of the people here, just as our people then, regard the current discussion not only as being completely silly, but view the attitude of the conservatives, who are firmly opposed to rationing, as a sign of weakness. These people, who next to the Russians know more of what all-out war means than any other people, are not reluctant to pull in their belts additional notches if it means, as it does in the case of fuel rationing, another step in the direction of industrial victory. Yet the Sunday Times editorializes that fuel rationing would create inevitable inequalities and leave in its wake poignant and embittering memories. That kind of reasoning is not only hard to follow, but difficult to understand. Directly to the point in putting the situation in a nutshell is the statement that unless immediate steps are taken now, the coal famine will hold up the war industries next year. Coal is this island's biggest asset, but says the cooperative sheet Reynolds News, it will cease to be Britain's biggest headache only when the coal problem is tackled boldly and imaginatively. Two taxicab drivers with whom I talked to yesterday put it this way. The government had better start rationing now and not when the winter sets in, when all of us will be needing warmth. 5 days ago, a lone Nazi raider shot across the channel. Its bomb racks were full. Inside of 20 minutes, it was opening up its belly over a small coastal village in southern England. Late yesterday afternoon, the raider's 29 victims, school children and their headmaster, were lowered into a common grave. Their death again accented the enemy's definition of total war. In answering such merciless bombings has been the effect of raids which the British have been conducting over the enemy-held continent, raids being made increasingly effective as a result of the high development of night photography. Now, when the British bombers release their messages of destruction, photographic flash bombs speed toward the target. On exploding, they produce a blinding light for about one-tenth of a second with a brilliancy equal to 50 million candle power. Now, this is Alex Dreyer in London, returning you to New York.
Now go ahead, David Anderson in Stockholm.
This is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. During the past couple of weeks, the situation in Denmark has been the cause for no little concern here in the north. On the surface, Denmark presents a rather peaceful picture. The Danish food situation is still one of the best in Europe. Her fuel supplies are naturally low, but not yet catastrophic. and the Danes have even had a certain control over their clearing account with Germany. Despite a few cases of sabotage, work seems to go on normally in the increasing number of factories working for the Germans, and the Germans are getting their fair share of Danish foodstuffs. Characteristic of this is the fact that meat consumption during the first 6 months of 1942 exceeded the pre-war figure. It is possible that British bomb raids have affected certain Danish nerve centers, and that a few parachutists have escaped the watchful eye of the German and Danish guards. But as yet, it does not seem as though the German military authorities have found any military reasons for discarding their principle not to interfere in Danish internal affairs. However, it is pretty well recognized that the German civil administration working under the occupational authorities, the German political leaders, and the Danish Nazis would like to bring Denmark into the greater Germany. The pressure put on the Danish leaders may be seen in the recent radio speech of Prime Minister Buhl, in which he suggested the introduction of new legal measures if sabotage did not end. House investigations, raids, and the return of the so-called Danish Free Corps are further substantiation of the growing tension in Denmark. It is generally believed that the Danish Free Corps were to act as a sort of Gestapo, although the newspapers in Denmark assure the people that they will return to the front on the 18th of October. Whatever the future of Denmark may be, it is clear that she is passing through her most critical period since April 1940. But still, the Danes seem not to be affected by provocations or propaganda. They have put their faith in Prime Minister Buhl's will to protect the interests of the country, and they are solidly behind King Christian. As Dagens Nyheter puts it, King Christian is the incarnation of Denmark's right and the guarantee of her future freedom and honor. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
And now for the latest developments in our own capital, we take you to the newsroom in Washington.
The War Department, which speaks of divergent campaigns in its communiques, has begun such a movement of its own, and this one will take some pressure off Congress. An intensified campaign for the recruiting of 18 and 19-year-olds for the Army has begun. This new group will be given a much wider range of choice than before in choosing the branch of service in which they are to serve. The fledglings, with written consent of their parents, may serve in the Quartermaster Corps, Chemical Welfare Service, Medical Department, and the Corps of Military Police. Although, believe it or not, the last branch will probably go begging for volunteers. MPs were the most unpopular gentlemen in the Army during the last World War, and that reputation has stuck until now. If you ask the average youngster why he dislikes MPs, all he can think of is, nobody likes them, that's that. Probably a carryover from that MP verse in Hinky Dinky Parlez-Vous. Anyway, the common idea about MPs is all wrong, and the Army will be out to prove it to these youngsters. And they're receiving excellent help from this war's batch of MPs who have distinguished themselves as gentlemen and mediators, even among the men. Ask any of them. Incidentally, other branches are open to 18 and 19-year-olds. Ask your recruiting officer. Now, in some side glances at Washington news, we hear only whispered, of course, that Attorney General Biddle will be the man to succeed Mr. Burns on the Supreme Court, and whispers about disaffection and disunity among the Democrats will break into a roar about election time, according to close-to-the-hill informants. Chief gripe is against the non-patronage habits of Leon Henderson. Leon has chosen key war figures the country over with no regard to party line or political enemies. Many congressional members are hoping, therefore, but only in trusted circles, of course, that the administration is defeated in November, so party organization will have to be torn down and reconstructed along new lines and with new bosses. Incidentally, don't be surprised to see John Nance Garner back in Washington. Some think the president's gesture appears to be more than a gesture when you glance at it twice. Though the president's trip wasn't political, old Cactus Jack always could do more to cement broken relations in the party than anyone else. And last, don't hope for much of a replacement for your worn tires under the tire freezing program if you have only an A card. But if you hold any other, shout hallelujah, because the jalopy will be shod for the duration if OPA figures are correct. And that's all from Washington.
You have been listening to the News of the World, reported by our correspondents at home and overseas. We heard this morning from Australia, Moscow, London, Stockholm, and Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.